miracle. Appreciate that. God is good. All right, so we're going to be more relaxed this time. I'm not in the mood of either preaching or lecturing. I'm in the mood of sharing with you. So at any given moment, please feel free to interrupt me if there's anything that we can clarify. Or even if you have constructive comments, I don't mind it at all. On the contrary, I'll be happy to improve my presentation. So the question is obvious in the title. And it's also true that we are challenged in the 21st post-Christian century. You know, it's interesting that the spirit of this century in the secular world can be, it's usually defined like this. Everything is relative, and that's absolute. I mean, I find it really very, very sad that logic has been eliminated as a self-standing discipline in any curricula at any level. Because what logic does, it allows you to question and argue on a topic. And I'll give you one example. I have been once having an interesting exchange with a young man. He was at that age that Oscar Wilde described like this. He said, I don't know everything, I'm not that young. Well, this man was that young. And he said to me, everything is relative. And I told him, you realize that what you're saying totally denies itself. Huh? Well, if you say that everything is relative, that means that that statement itself is relative. Oh, right, yeah, well, yeah, it's relative. Well, what's the opposite of relative? Absolute. So you see, absolute makes sense. Relative makes no sense. And he was lost. So I believe that apologetics should go down always on this logic avenue. And there is one fundamental element that Christians can always use in any single discussion. So instead of presenting this later, I'd rather do it now. I feel like now it's the right moment to do it. Here it is. It's almost unavoidable as you debate with an atheist to tell you that it's not right for Christians to claim they have the absolute truth. You heard that, right? Now here's what you have to tell them. Not right according to what? How do you decide what's good, what bad, or what is bad, what's right is what is not right, unless there's a giver of the law? There's an absolute frame of reference. I remember on one occasion, Ravi Zacharias was debating a young academic, and he was exactly along the same lines, you know, the young academic. You can't say what's good, what's not good, because there's no such thing. Oh. Okay, so if I took a brand newborn baby alive and in front of you I sliced it like this, would that be wrong? And the academic was cornered. So you know what he said? No, it wouldn't be wrong, but I wouldn't like it. So see, leave it to humans to define what's good and what's not good, and they have no basis. That's why we need a lawgiver. So now, going back to the worldview. Now, what is a worldview after all? It's an explanation of reality that can answer the following questions in a logical and coherent fashion. Where do I and the world come from? Why am I here? Is the world good or bad, and why? What happens to me and the world in the end? You see, these are questions that, if they can be answered within the same system of logical truth, then you have a coherent worldview. And that's exactly what atheists cannot do. Because they might give you the answer that you come from randomness, that you are here for no purpose, but then they're going to tell you the world is neither good nor bad. The world is. And that's not the answer to the question. We have all the answers in one system, and we find it in the Word of God. Now here's an example of what having a true biblical worldview means. It comes from the Bible itself. 2 Kings 6. And when... Oh, what happened here? Technology. This is the ultimate proof we all fell short of the glory of God, I tell you. Yeah, it changes fast in there, but it doesn't change in here. All right, so. And when the servant of the man of God arose early and went out, there was an army surrounding the city with horses and chariots. And the servant said to him, "Alas, my master, what shall we do?" So he answered, "Do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them." And Elijah prayed and said, "Lord, I pray, open his eyes that he may see." Then the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw. And behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elijah. You probably remember the story. The emperor of the Arameans, or the Syrians, invaded Israel. And Elisha was telling all the time to the king where the Syrians will be. So he always anticipated their moves. And the Aramean king got really mad. "Who's doing this?" "Well, there's this guy, Elijah. I want him captured." So this happens. This is when he's caught in the city. And remember what he does eventually? He doesn't say, "Now that the chariots of fire are there, send them, wipe out the Syrian army." He says, "Blind them." And then he guides them into the city of Dothan. And once they're inside the walls, what does he do? "Now let's crush them, let's kill them." No. Feed them, give them drinks. And as a result, the Syrians never invaded the place again. It was a lesson for them. Seeing the real facts, seeing the real meaning of all those episodes in their lives, that is a biblical worldview. And Elijah definitely had it, didn't he? And he prayed for his servant's eyes to be open. In 1 John 4, here's what we read. "You are of God, little children, and have overcome them, because he who is in you is greater than he who is in the world." It resembles a little bit 2 Kings, doesn't it? "They are of the world, therefore they speak as of the world, and the world hears them." Now there are two things in here. First of all, definitely, that once we are not from this world or of this world, we see and speak differently. But the fact that the world hears them, it doesn't hear us today, might be also due to the fact that we speak a language the world doesn't understand anymore. Here I'm repeating again my example. We are commanded to be salt and light. But how can we be salt if we don't taste the food first? How do you know how much you need to add? By simply labeling this culture as pagan and fallen and not trying to understand it, we will not be able to address it in the areas that are the most effective to be addressed. I'm not saying embrace it. I'm simply saying understand it. And that's why the ones amongst us who are strong enough in faith should not stay away from this culture. And I'm talking about movies, I'm talking about certain books, and I'm talking about certain radio programs or TV programs. We need to scout them. We need to be there to see what's going on and then address those specifically. But once again, I make this point very clear. Only the ones amongst you who feel strong enough not to be corrupted by those things, because the devil is very powerful in those things. And I will give you an example that I personally have used repeatedly. I'm a movie buff. And that's because mainly movies was one of the ways we fought the communist system in Romania. And the second one was music. See, movies in Romania were not dubbed, they were subtitled. So if you knew a language, then you could hear the real dialogue. So anyway, there's a movie, for example, by James Cameron. It's called The Abyss. Some of you might have seen it. But here's an interesting element. It talks about some aliens hiding at the bottom of the Caiman Trench, you know, deep in the ocean. And at some point, humans tried to nuke them, crazy army people. That's James Cameron's obsession. And one civilian actually offers his life, essentially, going down to the bottom of the trench and cutting off that bomb. So now the aliens send a signal. Mind you, these are watery creatures. They live in the ocean. They can do with the water whatever they want. And that signal, that warning, is a huge tsunami which moves towards all inhabited shores in the shape of a wall of water, hundreds of meters high, towering over skyscrapers. And the water stops right at the edge. Everybody's horrified. It stands like that. You can see the birds and helicopters flying against it. And then it goes back. So I tell, okay, for any science fiction movie watcher, this seems okay. I mean, these are aliens capable of traveling through deep space and time. And of course, they can manipulate water any way they want because that's their environment. There's no problem. But when you tell the same guys that God parted the waters of one sea alone, the Red Sea, fantasies. You see the matter of perspective here? Another example, The Lord of the Rings. You know the story. You sit and chat with these young people. Said, okay, I have a question for you. Who decided that Sauron can only be destroyed by throwing the ring of fire into the lake of the ring into the lake of fire in Mount Doom? What do you mean, who decided? The writer. Uh-huh. So even the utmost evil actually is controlled by the writer. In the real world, God is the one who writes the scenario. You see, it's easy to take the next step, and you bring them into these issues from something they're familiar with and something they even like. To this day, it was a long time, I didn't understand why do I still remember names of rock bands and rock artists, since I'm not interested in them anymore. Because I often talk to young people and I start from there. They say, that's music, now let me send you some music back there and play this and listen to that. And lo and behold, suddenly I'm not from Mars or some alien planet, I'm somebody who they can understand. And once we establish the bridge, then we can talk about the real things. So that's what I actually had in mind. Now, of course, when I'm speaking about this worldview and how to approach the other worldview, one of the things we also need to understand is where has the church started making mistakes so that we lost this culture? Because let's face it, we lost it. There was a time when the culture was essentially Christian. That time is gone. And here's one of the many examples. Charles Hodge is considered one of the greatest systematicians in modern theology. And he wrote in Systematic Theology at page 119, "The Bible is to the theologian what nature is to the man of science. It's his storehouse of facts." Well, that's very much the Baconian approach. You know what? Don't worry about scientists and what they do. What are they going to come? What's their conclusion? Eventually, it's going to be that God created the world, right? So fine. Don't worry about that. Except science took the totally opposing direction, and today it says that religion was an evolutionary invention. In their struggle for dominating species on this planet, humans invented religion because that kept them together, gave them a purpose. But now that we are the dominant species, it's time to dump religion. We don't need it anymore. Several hundred pages later, Charles Hodge says this: "The church has been forced more than once to alter her interpretation of the Bible to accommodate the discoveries of science. But this has been done without doing any violence to the scriptures or in any degree impairing their authority." What? I mean, if you say Genesis 1 to 11 is not real, because science says it's not real, Now you twist your interpretation of the scripture so that you can accommodate science. You have not impaired the authority of the scripture. It's in the same book. I'd like to compare this to the following text, and I'm not going to tell you who wrote it. It's a delicious text, both in what it says and how it says it. I love this English. We are invited, brethren, most earnestly, to go away from the old-fashioned belief of our forefathers because of the supposed discoveries of science. What is science? The method by which man tries to conceal his ignorance. It should not be so, but so it is. You are not to be dogmatical in theology, my brethren. It is wicked. But for scientific men, it's the correct thing. You are never to assert anything very strongly, but scientists may boldly assert what they cannot prove and may demand a faith far more credulous than any we possess. Forsooth, you and I are to take our Bibles and shape and mold our belief according to ever-shifting teachings of so-called scientific men. What folly is this? Why, the march of science, falsely so-called, through the world, may be traced by exploded fallacies and abandoned theories. Former explorers once adored are now ridiculed. The continual wreckings of false hypotheses is a matter of universal notoriety. You may tell where the learned have encamped by the debris left behind of suppositions and theories as plentiful as broken bottles. It just gives you an idea how tourism was performed in those years. They had the picnic by the roadside and they're just throwing the bottles like that. Very, very unlike PEI, eh? Anyway, you know who this is? Compare that to Charles Hodge. Interesting, isn't it? We usually teach them together. Remember I told you that I believe that the basic elements of a Christian worldview is God creating a perfect world which was marred by the sin, and that's why we need redemption today. Now, according to the naturalistic, evolutionary, secular worldview, about 4.7 billion years ago, grain after grain of dust in space started coming together, and they coalesced. They piled on top of each other until there was enough gravity in there to compress them and triggered an internal furnace which produced heat. And that heat eventually made it to the surface and melted the crust. And about a billion years later, the conditions were ripe for two molecules who were born to be just individual molecules, joined forces, and for the first time life emerged from non-life. And you know the whole story. But one needs to understand something. There's no way you have both worldviews correct. If the secular worldview is correct, then the Bible-based worldview is incorrect. And just to remind you that Darwin, who actually had a degree in divinity, didn't want to have anything to do with the Bible, here's what he wrote in his autobiography. The Old Testament, from its manifestly false history of the world, with the Tower of Babel, the rainbow as a sign, etc., and from its attributing to God the feelings of a revengeful tyrant, was no more to be trusted than the sacred books of the Hindus or the beliefs of any barbarian. But it is because of attitudes like Hodge, for example, that a great division entered the church. It is when science became quite an impressive, self-standing intellectual establishment that this idea was pushed forward and embraced by most churches, that there is an upper level which deals with spirituality, with the spirit, and that is what the church does. And then there's a lower level which deals with facts, and that's what science does. But once you accept this division, logically, you're also accepting that spirituality is not a fact. And if it is not a fact, then what is it? An invention. We should have never accepted that division. As for science and the way it works, here's again this graph. I just hope that it'll make sense. And if it doesn't, please just let me know. I don't want to force it upon you, but it's good to remember it this way. You know, you will hear over and over and again and read this in the newspapers and all that new evidence for evolution was found or new evidence for creation was found. In reality, nobody ever finds any kind of evidence All we find are facts, something that our senses perceive, a rock, a bone, whatever. So those are sensorial facts, facts that are perceived by our senses. Now, we start interpreting them by using a filter. That's a first approach. And this filter is what we call science today. And how it operates is very simple, through observation, through logic, through experiment, and prediction. So now we took the facts from the sensorial level and translated them through the filter into scientific facts. But a scientific fact does not mean much to us. Now we have to incorporate the scientific fact into what? Into a worldview. How does that scientific fact fit into our worldview? You understand that? Because if you do not fit it, then it doesn't mean much to you anyway. You just pass it by. Well, that means that you already have a worldview. Francis Bacon thought that we can do it in reverse. Just pile up the facts, run experiments, make predictions, and then you build a worldview. And he even believed that the church should do the same thing, approach the scripture without any bias. Today, this Baconian inductive method has been long time abandoned because you cannot look at facts without a preconceived idea in your mind. You're either born into a worldview or educated into a worldview, but it is not that you choose it by way of no worldviews initially. So now, if you have an atheistic paradigm, which is the Greek word for worldview, then you take the facts, interpret them through the filter, and you come to the conclusion the universe is natural, that it exists by itself, is eternal. There is no God. Or you can start with a theistic paradigm, a worldview that believes there is a God who created everything. You look at the same facts, you use the same science, and your conclusion is that the universe is created, that it exists by itself. You see what happens here? So science should not be changing our worldview. Science should operate within our worldview. And in a truly democratic world, in a truly free world, a person should be free to choose to stay in the paradigm in which was born and educated or change it of its own free will. But the fact is that in this society, which is called free society, if you go to public schools, you are forced within only one paradigm. Regardless of where you come from, this is what you have to do. Now, I'll tell you a story. It's been about 5 years now. I spoke in Tumbler Ridge, BC. And this young lady, a year later, at the end of the speaking in the church, they have arranged for me to speak in two local schools. Actually, it's the same building, but it was a grade 7 and a grade 10 that I was, 11 that I was to address. And the night between I spoke, I need to tell you that BC is the only province in this country that has a specific law that forbids everything else but evolution being even mentioned in school. You can't mention intelligent design in school because you lose your job. So the seventh grade teacher wanted to have a chat with me. She said, you know, I just got my job last year, and I've been receiving very nasty letters and emails from parents that I should not bring a religious guy into the school. It's against the law. So you know what? I would prefer you not to come, and I hope you're not offended. And I said, no, it's fine. Sure, I understand that. The grade 11 biology teacher, on the other hand, she was long established in that school, she said, listen, here's the text of the law. Can you abide by it? I looked at it and said, sure, no big deal. I can do it. However, she says, I need to have you videotaped in case any of the parents have any objections, because she also received nasty letters, pressure from the community not to have this religious guy in there. So I said, fine, you can film me. So I went and I talked, mathematics, chemistry, and physics. No mention of intelligent design, no mention of God, nothing. And at the end, a young lady asked me, now we all know what you are. How does your faith harmonize with your science? And I said, well, you see, it is a question that came from you guys, and I have to mention it, to answer it. Yes, I believe in God. And I believe everything that I presented to you here proved that. And it was the end of it. I never got any problems for going against the law. But the very next year, I was back speaking at a camp, and this lady came to me. She said, well, first of all, I graduated one of the top 10 students in Canada that year. And we all 10 have been given a free boat ride on board a research vessel to the Arctic Ocean as potential future scientists. So she said, after I came home, I was a local celebrity. And I was offered to work through the summer as a guide at the dinosaur camp there. Actually, they have a dinosaur trail trip, so people come and pay and they go. And she said, I went to them, I said, I'd love to do this, but you know, I do not believe the evolutionary story about the dinosaurs. And if I am to work for you, I would like to tell people my creationist story about dinosaurs. And they said, no, you cannot do that. You have to tell them what we tell you. And then she said, you know what, then I'm not interested in the job. A young lady with moral fiber. She said no to at least $3,000 working in her backyard, doing something really pleasant. Next year, we met in Prince George, and she told me, you know what? I decided I'm so disgusted with the schooling system, the whole system here, that I'm not going to become a scientist, but a missionary. What do you think? And I hope God gave me the right answer, because I said, no, it is obvious to me that you have the gift for science, and we need people like you in the universities. Now, if your faith is strong enough, go and follow your call. You're going to do a lot of service to your fellow Christians if you're there, both by witnessing and being able to know the establishment from inside. I know that she's a student. I haven't met her ever since, but you see what we have to do? It almost made me feel back in communist Romania. We're doing things hidden. Now, all this thing about science interpreting the facts is based on one huge assumption. And that assumption is that the universe is rational at all levels. Because the universe is not rational, there's no way you can do science. And interestingly enough, this view only emerges from the Judeo-Christian worldview. It is only Judeo-Christianity that speaks about a rational God creating a rational universe governed by rational laws, and man, his creation, being endowed with the same reason, therefore he can study and understand creation. You won't have this in Hinduism, where there's millions of gods, and they do whatever they want, they never establish any rules. Or in Buddhism, or even in Islam, where Allah's will is unknown, you can count that things are going to be the same tomorrow. Judeo-Christianity is the only one that provided such an environment, such a worldview. And sure enough, it is out of Judeo-Christianity that modern science has emerged. Here's an example for you to ponder. The Chinese have invented gunpowder, and for 600 years they used it mostly for firecrackers, some missiles. The Europeans stole it from them, and because they had empirical science, they right away invented fire weapons and conquered the world with it, because they had empirical science. Now, let me show you how powerful the paradigm can be, how powerful the worldview that somebody chooses to have and to stick to can be. Here's a picture of a real dinosaur foot track, or trail if you wish, from Morrison, Colorado. It's a famous location. Now, what would the Christians say as it looks like at it? Well, sure, that's a dinosaur track, right? What would an atheist say as he looks at it? It's a dinosaur track. So this far, both worldviews are the same. Say now that somebody one day will discover in the rock on the same layer this, a human skeleton. Now, what do you think a Christian would say now about that? How will he interpret the scientific fact? Well, according to his paradigm, It's very obvious. That's a human who died during Noah's flood when dinosaurs also died. That's what you expect from a Christian, right? What do you think an atheist would do, though? He would say, well, that's a human who traveled through time from the future using a time machine. And somehow he died in there. And that's logical and acceptable within his paradigm. If he wants to stick to his paradigm, he has to do that. There's no other way out. So he's consistent with his paradigm, and a Christian is consistent with his paradigm. Let's take it to the next step. A person dies, is certified to be dead, is buried 6 feet under, and 3 days later emerges from the grave alive. For a Christian, it's very obvious that that is a clear case of another resurrection, like Lazarus and, of course, Jesus Christ. It confirms that God performs miracles and resurrects people. What do you think an atheist will have to say at this? Well, you know what? There's an infinity of parallel universes, the so-called multiverse theory. And in one of those universes, an identical person existed and just crossed into this one. Mind you, again, it makes perfect sense in their paradigm. And that's the only way out, so they have to interpret the fact according to their paradigm. So does the Christian. Let's now take this to the final, the ultimate hypothetical situation, because what I'm showing here, these are all hypothetical situations, right? Here's an atheist who meets his maker. And that is my favorite atheist over there, Richard Dawkins. And his maker, of course, is Charles Darwin, right? That's a famous painting by Michelangelo in the Sistine Chapel. It's been just tweaked around a little bit. So, say now the real God, Yahweh, comes down like Michelangelo meant it and said, oh, hello, Richard. I am Yahweh, the God of the Scriptures. I know you don't believe in me, and you don't even believe I'm here, but tell me what miracle you would like me to perform for you so that you will believe. And Richard Dawkins says, okay, do this for me. And God does it. He, Richard Dawkins, might say what he said in the documentary, Expelled. Sir, why did you take such a pain to hide from me? That was actually what Bertrand Russell said, if he was ever to meet God. But I suspect that now he changed his mind, and Richard Dawkins is going to go this way. Now, wait a minute. I know there is no God. So this cannot be real either. Somebody is playing with my brain, tampering with my brain. Maybe this is some sort of matrix. If you've seen the movie, I physically exist in a pod immersed in a fluid in a deep state of sleep, and there's a computer who sends into my brain through a plug a virtual reality in which there is a God. And once again, it makes perfect sense. In his paradigm, that's the only cop-out. So you see, there's no scientific fact that can convince an atheist, not even sensorial fact. He will always explain it within his paradigm, and that's okay, as long as Christians are free to do the same thing at every single level in society, including in schools. But we are not. Now let me challenge you at this point and ask you this. Can you imagine one scientific fact that will convince you that there is no God? Can you? Because if you can, you need to work on your Christian worldview. Consistency, always. No compromise. This is not an area of infinite nuances of gray or shades of gray. Not even a whiter shade of pale. But this is a territory of black and white. Period. Now here's a guy who used to be an evolutionist, and I believe now he's a creationist, because he died. And Sagan wrote this in his book. If God is omnipotent and omniscient, why didn't he start the universe out in the first place so that it would come out the way that he wants? Why is he constantly repairing and complaining? No, there's one thing the Bible makes clear. The biblical God is a sloppy manufacturer. He's not good at design, he's not good at execution. He'd be out of business if there was any competition. Now I'd like to share with you some examples of sloppy manufacturing on behalf of God. And what I challenge you to do, think evolution for a moment and try to imagine evolutionary stages through which the creatures that I'm going to show you now have come into existence by slow evolutionary changes. Some of you have seen this, but I hope it's okay if I repeated it. Here's the Bombardier beetle. It's a whole group of beetles that defend themselves this way. If they're attacked, and could it be a frog, it could be a bird, it could be a meerkat, they turn around and spray it right between the eyes with that sticky, hot, acidic liquid they produce at the rear end. And that is produced this way. In its belly, in its abdomen, it has two little pouches. One contains hydroquinone, which we use to develop films, and the other one, peroxide, which some people use to get blonder than they should be. But who am I to decide those things? Now, there are two little pumps in here controlled by a gland. And if the two chemicals are mixed in the very precise amounts, then this violent chemical reaction happens and the jet is produced. But miss it by a microgram and either no jet or kaboom and you die. Now try to imagine evolutionary steps through which this critter discovers first that if you mix hydroquinone with peroxide, none of them existing normally in bugs, you get this violent chemical reaction and they start experimenting. So the first generation goes like this, okay, today is the day of experiment. We're going to take 1 microgram of hydroquinone and 1 microliter of peroxide. Kaboom, dies. Nobody to take notes. There's no way to hand on that information. Guys, don't do that anymore. According to Darwin, every single intermediate stage towards this final product should be viable, survive, and produce offspring. It's been designed like that, or we have a serious problem here. Here's the archerfish. By the way, if somebody can get me a transparent glass of water with some water in it and a pen, can somebody do that for me now? Please. Okay, the archerfish lives in the Amazonian jungle and looks like this. It's a fairly small fish. And this is what it does for a living. Gets a mouthful of water, and there's plenty of water in the Amazon, and it sees an insect on a twig or in a branch or a blade of grass and splashes it with the water. So the insect falls into the water, and the fish goes and catches it and eats it. It is amazing because you see the insect falls and the fish just takes one sight and dashes and oftentimes gets to the point that the insect is falling before it gets there. Now the best catchers in baseball or American football, they don't do that. Okay, kick the ball, so I run, I turn around, I catch it. No, they keep adjusting, right? This fish is not doing it. Takes a aim, poof, waits for the insect to come, exactly where it falls. How does it do that? And then there's another thing. I hope to be able to show you this. Yeah. Some of you remember it, but for the young guys here maybe, or the ones who've forgotten this, it's a simple thing. You see, light travels differently through air and water. So what we have is a different index of refraction. So, thank you very much. If I put the pen in, does it appear to be broken? Right where the water, the air meet? See? It's broken. That's an illusion because of the refraction of light. You know what that means? That fish has no way to see the insect where it is. Because the same thing happens if you look from underneath, from the water. It never misses, though. Now, why is that? Because it has a correction device in the brain, the sort of internal glasses, correction glasses, which we don't have yet, much better than contact lens. Now, question is, how did the fish discover that it has an optical problem and then solve it? Think about it. This fish was designed like that. It's funny how some textbooks are trying to avoid this thing by saying, wait a minute. Actually, the fish doesn't aim from underneath the water. His eyes are above the water, so there's no distortion. Look at the picture. He's underwater. Others say, well, actually, the fish only shoots vertically, right underneath the insect where there's no distortion. It's from an angle. So the mystery remains. If it wasn't designed like that, forget it. Here's another example. Yes?
What would you say to someone that said maybe one of the archer fish had a mutation that changed his eyes and then he was able to shoot more bugs and his genes kind of passed on?
So then they had to find a female fish which had the same mutation to produce offspring with that mutation. And the chances of exactly the same mutation being transmitted systematically every single time. But just a simple mutation would not cause an eye defect. It's way more than that. You know, so it's like theoretically you can imagine something like this, but then you run the numbers and you realize that there's no way it could have happened in the real world. You know, it's amazing when I get guys saying, listen, is the probability of that happening by mutation zero? No, I say it's not zero. It's 1 to minus 4 million. That's 1 divided by 10 followed by 4 million zeros. Well, since it's not zero, it's still possible. Yeah, sure. Welcome to the real world. Learn a little bit of mathematics. Now, here's another case of sloppy manufacturing. The gecko lizard, right? And here's my favorite one, climbing on a stalactite. Now, you see, geckos can actually climb or walk on perfectly flat glass ceilings. Flies cannot do that. So how can they achieve such an incredible feat? Well, we have to study some geckonomics to understand that. Here's the first thing. Geckos have tiny hairs, 200 millionths of a millimeter thick on their toes. Here's a picture of that. Now, every single hair has a tip, a pad at its tip, excuse me. Here's a scanning electron microscope showing, photograph showing that, those little pads. Those are not suckers, as pads. Every single hair interacts with all surfaces through the van der Waals forces, or because of the van der Waals forces. These are the electrostatic forces that bind molecules together. So the hairs are so fine that they can actually use that force that binds everything together. In there. May the force, be with you. By the way, have you heard this, that the 4th of May is the International Star Wars Day? Have you heard it? May the 4th be with you. Okay. The combined hairs on one gecko generate enough to lift a 280-pound person. The gecko is just about this big. And finally, the hairs repel dirt. You can literally stick it in the stickiest mud, shakes his feet, and it's clean. And you can even take out a hair like that and just put the hair in the dust, in the dirt, shake it, it's clean. It naturally repels dirt. They're trying now to imitate it by creating a reusable scotch tape. Now, how did this creature discover the van der Waals forces? They had to go all the way to at least grade 9 physics just to hear about them, let alone using them, and then create all that nanotechnology. I mean, select all those mutations that theoretically could have caused something like this, like hairs like that appearing on their toes, because most lizards have no hairs, and all those incredible changes. And by the way, again, every single intermediate stage had to be viable. And by the way, they should have left some remains in the fossil record, and there's nothing in there. Geckos were always geckos, period. All right, now, I was trying to say, during my presentations, use the information argument. That was a fairly sophisticated one. Let me try again. What causes, or how did God actually put all these things together for us Christians? It's not that he took hair by hair or atom by atom or something. He structured them by certain laws. And those laws are known today as information. Now, information, in order to work, to achieve something, needs a number of things. Number one, here I am as a source of information, and I'm saying this: we cannot allow facts ruin a beautiful theory. Now, what did I do? I sent a signal, which is the vibration of my vocal cords, through a channel, which is the air in this room. If there was void in this room, you couldn't hear it, could you? But information is still incomplete. It still doesn't do anything. It needs something else. the recipient or the receivers, if you wish, which are you, right? Now, what did I do technically to do all to convey this information? First of all, I grouped 46 signs, which are the letters, all the letters, into 8 words and 7 spaces that built one sentence, right? If you count the letters, the 47 letters, or 8 words and 7 spaces. Then, I used a language that you understand, English, because if I did this in Romanian, you would have not understood. So I already had to know that you know English, right? And I also had to know English. I wanted you to know the truth, that the modern secular establishment does not allow facts ruin a beautiful and established theory. Eventually, I wanted you also to smile, which essentially means contracting the orbicular muscles around your mouth. In order to achieve all these reactions from you, I first of all had to do what? All these complicated things. Plus, know that you can hear and you would react this way. Otherwise, it would have made no change at all, no difference. So what I mean to say here is that I had to send you information in an intelligent way. And intelligent information comes from an intelligence. It cannot come from matter or energy. And matter and energy actually submit to information. Professor Paul Davies puts it this way in The New Scientist. How could stupid atoms spontaneously write their own software? Nobody knows. Well, mind you, the first atom that ever existed in the universe ran by certain rules, obeyed them. And it means the rules had to exist before the atom. And of course, there's no known law that can create information from nothing. Information only comes from an intelligent source. It cannot come from matter or energy. And I was presenting this tremendous amount of information out there by this parallel. So that's a spiral of information. It's actually the whirlpool galaxy. Let's put in the center the basic unit to measure information, which is known as a bit, an individual signal. That's a bit. When you group 8 of those together, you get a byte with a Y. And that's where the science of informatics actually starts. Now, a kilobyte, which is 1,000 bytes, is the equivalent of playing the piano for a minute. If you ask me what, I'll tell you. Mozart. Now, a CD-ROM's capacity, 1/5 of its capacity, actually, is 10 to the 8 power bytes of information. All human knowledge ever written into books throughout entire human history amounts to 10 to the 18 power bytes of information. A human body, in order to function every single day, it needs 10 to the 25th power bytes of information. So a human body needs several of order magnitudes more information than humans have ever created. Let me explain how this works. You see, we are not a sum of chemicals. We are a sum of processes running on chemicals controlled by information. Every single chemical reaction in our body taken individually kills us. But there's a software which says, okay, this chemical reaction unfolds for 2 nanoseconds, then stops and this one comes, then that one and that one. And the amount of information to control all those chemical reactions amounts to 10 to the 25th bytes of information every day. How about the entire universe? It all needs information to function, doesn't it? Where does the information come from? Well, we all know it comes from the Trinity, from God himself. So let's just put this very simple scheme together. When God places the proper information into matter, into energy, excuse me, energy becomes matter, structured energy. Now, when matter receives the proper information from God, it becomes organic matter. When God places the proper information into organic matter, it becomes life, a functional set of organic matters. When life receives the proper information, it becomes a self-conscious life, a life that knows it's there. And when a self-conscious life is supplied with the proper information from God, what does emerge? A religious system. Because now, if you know that you existed, and you know enough, you know you're not existing by chance. because somebody wanted you to exist. Somebody created you. And guess what? Seems logical that someone wants to communicate with you, and you would like to have a chat with him or her, whatever you believe. So, you have a system of beliefs. And you know, all this concept of information controlling matter is already there in the scripture, if you have a Christian worldview. The Gospel of John begins with, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." Right? Well, what is the Word if not information? And when Jesus was tempted while he was fasting by the devil to turn the stones into bread, he answered, "It is written, man does not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God." Now, what is the word that comes from the mouth of God is not pure information. We are supplied by it every single moment. That's why we function. And finally, when God created everything out of nothing, did he physically take the nothing into his hands and shape it into everything? God said, "Let there be," and there was. God spoke things into existence. That is, he placed the proper rules, the information in there, and things were happening. That is the power of the Word. So that's what really controls. And now, if you think about it, if this universe is matter and energy, and information had to exist before, means that before there was the universe, there was the information. And that is God himself, the source of information. So my dear friends, you see, the Christian worldview is so simple to live every single day, and it's so effective in explaining everything. But there is an important thing we need to understand first, that our brains have been designed in such a way that they can only function by comparing opposites. We do not understand darkness unless we know what light is. We cannot understand warmth until we know what cold is. There's no up if there's no first down, and so on and so forth. That's the only way we can function. So when we are submitted to the pressure of education in any single shape and form, we're always caught between these two things. We always have to simplify it down to either this or that. There are no nuances in there. So, you need to train yourselves as much as you can to separate facts from interpretations of facts. You will be surprised how much of the things that they teach in the academia today are interpretations, yet they teach them as facts. If you do that, if you have this ability, if you basically turn this into sort of permanent intellectual game to keep you sharp and going, you'll be free. And that applies to what I told you too, and to everything that you hear from the pulpit too. Because we know there's only one frame of reference that needs not to be tested anymore by a higher one, which is the word of the Creator himself. And that also is part of the Christian worldview. But believe me, it's much easier than you think. I'll give you an example. Some of you, of course, already heard it. But you always have these guys trying to catch you with a different, difficult question here and there, everywhere. If you said that God created the world, who created God? No, I like to see that one. And actually, Carl Sagan had it. He asks it. Well, you see, here's what happens when you take logic out from school. You don't teach it anymore as a self-standing discipline. Because when somebody discusses the issue of origins, needs to start by postulating something. When you postulate, you said, okay, this is something I don't have to prove. This is it. Okay? So you have to postulate that something or somebody is eternal. Because if nobody is eternal or nothing is eternal, there's no discussion about origins. It's just an infinite regression. So-and-so created so-and-so, who was created by so-and-so, who was created ad infinitum, back to the bitter ends. So there's no discussion. But if you want to discuss origins, you say, okay, it's either matter or God that is eternal. But somebody has to be eternal. It has no beginning. It's always been there. And materialists or atheists would say, yes, matter is eternal. And then you hit them hard with the question, where did the matter take the information from to organize? Because the information had to pre-exist matter. So matter cannot be eternal. And they have no answer to that. And these are simple things, actually. You don't have to have a PhD or something. So train yourselves. Revive your intellect if for some reason you have it resting it for a time. And I'm not trying to be offensive here. Let's face it, once we are in a church, we feel kind of protected. And we always use the same things, and that's fine. But once you're outside, oftentimes you have to be a different person because of that. Because our intellect functions differently out there. If you have a true Christian worldview, there's no difference. Any single corner or moment of your life. And by the way, when you have a true Christian worldview, whatever you do it like you do it for the Lord, not for your employee or something like that. Employer, or something like that. So that is the importance of a Christian and a Bible-based worldview. May God give you the strength to stick to your worldview in every single situation. Because believe me, that's exactly what he wants us to do. That's the only way that we, through God, can change the world. Otherwise, we're just poor witness. And that's has been happening for quite some time. It's time to put an end to it. Thank you very much.